The Workday Replay from Money FM 89.3.
Now, in the run-up to International Women's Day 2019, we've invited Amarjit Kaur, partner with his Qatar Wong and an advocate for gender equality, to talk us through the business case for it. As gender bias attracts renewed attention globally, find out how making female empowerment central to your business strategy can mutually reinforce growth and equality. Amarjit, pleasure to have you with us again this morning.
Hi, Howie. Good morning. Nice to be here again.
So the business case for gender equality, it'll help business, is what we're saying. Talk us through that.
Absolutely, Howie. I think it's essential to understand that we've reached a stage where there are countless studies that prove that gender equality, gender parity is excellent for companies' bottom line, right? There's a direct correlation between having women in the C-suite and profitability. The number of studies are too many to rattle off, but we've reached a stage where we need to accept that it is good for a company's bottom line, not just a company, but a macro level. It's great for countries. So if we take Singapore, a McKinsey study has shown that if we achieve gender parity by 2025, this will increase our national GDP by $26 billion. And at a global level, by 2025, it will increase our global output by $12 trillion. So not just good for companies, but good for countries, good for our nations as well, to have gender parity.
But this statistic, though, is, I imagine, not widely known or not accepted, you think? Because I have another alarming statistic. According to Catalyst, a nonprofit CEO watchdog, only 5% of S&P 500 companies are led by women. But there is another study that says 73% of global firms allege they have equal opportunity policies in place.
Yes, I've
read
that as well.
So you see that huge percentage, 73% say they have that sort of opportunity for women, but only 5% of large companies actually are led by women.
So I think
is this a case of people only choosing certain statistics they want to believe in?
I think, Howie, you hit the nail on the head, because it's quite one thing to say we have policies that support gender equality, support women, support diversity and inclusion. But it's quite another to move beyond tokenism into actually implementing these policies and supporting
a diverse workforce. Stage where it's only rhetoric.
I think I have it,
but I'm not putting it into use.
Yes, I think that's a big part of the problem. So companies have realized it's good to have. So just to tick it off the list, they will say, you know, we've got the policies in place. We are a company that supports gender equality. But what you see is then a mismatch between what they have on paper and what actually goes on in the companies, which really explains the dichotomy that you spoke about, right? How can it be that if so many companies, 70-odd percent, have such policies, why is this then not being seen in terms of the representation at the C-suite or at the board level? And that's where the mismatch comes in. Because while they may have gender-friendly policies, they're not doing enough to make sure that they hothouse their female talent such that they achieve seniority and end up in the boards, or they're not hiring the right people for the boards. And that's a real problem. So the statistics show what the situation is. But I think it's almost unquestionable that the statistics prove that it is positive for businesses to invest in women and women in leadership. So I think it's something companies need to really work on, move beyond the perfunctory into the practical and really put it into play.
Whose responsibility might that be, though? Are we going to make it legislation, force them to? Or you're hoping that companies sort of open their eyes and embrace this new way of working?
Actually, both. Both the options you pointed out would be an ideal confluence, right? So legislation should be there to say we prohibit discrimination in the workplace. Singapore doesn't have that yet. Most of the Western world does. So a lot of the change that they implement in those countries is driven by legislation. In countries like Singapore and Asia, it's business need driven, right? So within that business needs environment, it's the leaders of the company that need to take responsibility and say, we are committing to this, and not just put it in their policies, but to take every opportunity they can to remind their people that this is something that the companies value. It's as essential as all the other strategies and objectives that they put in place. It's not something that's secondary and it's on the back burner, just nice to have. So it has to be driven by the leaders of a company. And again, the statistics show that where company CEOs are invested in this, that trickles down and everybody else plays ball, because they know that not to do so would be detrimental to their own careers. So it has to be part of business objective.
Right. Let's talk about the attrition of women in the workforce. I'm going to use the chicken and egg analogy. The attrition comes because of these things in place. There are perhaps discriminatory practices in place in the company, or the other way around.
Okay, so as you said, chicken and egg, a lot of women, by the time they hit their mid-30s, realize that they, whilst they may have been very enthusiastic when they started out in terms of their own self-assessment of the opportunities for advancement, for promotion, etc., they tend to hit a bit of a snag in their 30s or in their mid-career, where they realize that actually that positivity, that optimism that they had about their own career trajectory hasn't necessarily materialized because they feel as if they haven't been given possibly equal opportunities or sufficient support in their journeys. This is often combined with the fact that by the time these women hit their mid-30s, they also decide to start a family.
Oh no, it's the maybe baby question. And again, that pregnancy tax, was it, that we talked about
before? Yes, the
maternity penalty.
Yes. So what happens is when they then decide to take a career break to have children, they realize that there is then a systemic discrimination against them, both in terms of their perceived competence as well as their commitment to work. So because they've taken time off, they've lost out on training opportunities while they're on their career break. They've lost out on work experience. And the longer they've been out of work, the harder it is for them to come back and negotiate for better pay and better positions. So this leaves them on the back foot compared to their male counterparts who, in that interim period while they were away, have progressed and done better for themselves. So this is what we call the motherhood penalty.
And this, of course, I think contributes to why the gender pay gap is relatively large.
Absolutely. It is one of the contributing factors, because when these women then come back to work, very often they find that they can't take on full-time employment. They take on casual work, part-time work, etc., so that they can balance their family commitments. And that's where it becomes essential to have flexible work schemes that allow women to balance their competing interests in their lives. Not just women, but, you know, we're realizing that as our population ages, even the people who are semi-retired or retired can actually actively contribute to the economy if you allow them the flexibility. And this ties in with our drive to build a strong local workforce.
I think we're heading in the right direction. It was just announced a day or two ago that perhaps it would extend the retirement age here in Singapore.
Yes, absolutely, okay. Which is very positive. I mean, a lot of people between 62 and 65 actually believe that they want to continue working, but because there's a retirement age, companies then say, well, you know, we can actually retire you by the law. So it's a step in the right direction for them to be looking at the increase in the retirement age and the re-employment age as well. So definitely a step in the right direction. And I think having a more diverse and inclusive workforce, including women, people who are elderly, is in our country's benefit.
Okay, let's head back to talking about women and say they've gone through giving birth to their children. They want to come back into the workforce. Again, should we then legislate companies? Whose responsibility is that? Chicken and egg.
Again. Ideally, you know, we do have strong maternity laws in place, right? So we know that maternity leave is legislated in Singapore. We have that protection.
But dare I say, coming back to work might not be the hugest hurdle, the biggest hurdle. The hurdle is then how far can you progress after you've taken that break versus your male counterpart who's had that 2-3 years of a running start.
Yes, absolutely. So one of the suggestions that constantly comes up is just as NS men, when they enter the workforce, very often companies bump up their pay to take into account the fact that they've lost effectively 2 years of their life where they could have been earning what they were earning, right? And therefore they are compensated for that time. One of the suggestions is that when working mothers come back to work, this should be accounted for in terms of a salary bump. To give them a bit of a head start, to give them a bit more incentive to come back and then to continue, because they often find themselves disadvantaged when they come back. Lots of things companies can do to really make it easier for women to come back to work. So having robust parental leave policies, right? Having strong policies in place that support mothers who may need flexibility in terms of time, in terms of working at hours that suit them, remote working, agile working, all those things are critical. And I'll give you an example. I recently spoke to a benefits and compensation manager of a tech a pretty large tech company. And what they offer is, so you know that health insurance generally covers physical health. They've decided to offer mental health self-insurance. So the company self-insures such that mothers who come back, if they suffer from postpartum depression, if they suffer from anxiety because of the competing demands on them, they can actually tap into this and get the mental health help that they need. Amongst that, women who've suffered miscarriages while they're working, they get to actually tap into this resource, which I think is really going over and beyond what the basic benefits packages in Singapore are, but it's wonderful.
It also sounds like Singapore's government is heading in the right direction as well. It recently announced that there'd be more benefits for mums wanting to come back to work, more coverage for complications that may come up during pregnancy as well.
Yes.
So again, I'm wondering though, perhaps we should be singing the, not well, singing, or making known more the statistics that show with more women in place at the higher echelons of business as well, that it's beneficial to the economy on the whole. Versus, yes, we're heartened and we're encouraged by all of these policies that are put in place to help women, etc. But it feels as though perhaps not enough people know that there are the benefits of allowing women to take control, allow women to be in the workforce.
Absolutely, Howie. And I think highlighting these positive statistics that show the contribution women make to the economy is one thing. But it's another to also say that when you have women on boards, you have women in leadership position, you then have a counterpoint. You have a view that says, look, I'm not buying into this group think. I think differently from all the men in the room. And this is my view. It's the fact that they contribute positively to creativity, to productivity as well, that needs to be taken into account. And I think the more exposure our public and our businesses have to this positive impact that women have in the workplace, the better it is for all of us. And businesses and legislation, government initiatives also need to work hand in hand. So as you said, the government's definitely heading in the right direction. More childcare subsidies for women looking to re-enter the workforce. I think that's a wonderful new initiative that came up in the Committee of Supply debates. But companies then need to know, okay, we need to offer jobs that allow these women to come back to the workforce. Another interesting initiative that's come up is the job sharing. Is a push towards job sharing. So the government's actually, MOM's coming up with a guideline to advise companies on how they can make job sharing work. So the companies need to understand, okay, this is the direction the government is heading in. We should also be taking a page from their book and be open to these sorts of flexible work arrangements.
It's a bit of an uphill task, I feel, as though, for it to actually trickle into where businesses conduct themselves, that they understand that women contribute just as much. Because I think it was that same McKinsey Global Institute report that you quoted, that if men and women played that identical role in the labor market, $28 trillion could be added to the global economy.
Yeah.
So that's not a small sum. Those are zeros I can't even count on my fingers and toes.
Yeah, it's a massive sum, but there is an inbuilt resistance towards changing old practices. So when you tell a company, we think you should look into job sharing, the immediate kickback you'll get is, well, it's inefficient because you've got two people doing it. And you know, what if they don't communicate? But I'll give you an example. I actually worked in the local government in London in an administrative role because it's the motherhood penalty. I had a pair of twins who interrupted my master's and I had to take a part-time job on. Now, within the local government in London, it was very common to have job sharing because they worked out the nuts and bolts of it. They had a system and it worked. So they had two people who were job shared. They had an overlap time. They had common systems, common documents, document sharing, and they worked it out. But I find that In Singapore, the instinct is to almost say, no, we've never done it before. It may not work. We don't want to invest money in hiring people for this if it's going to be a failed experiment.
Yeah, you go first. It might be dangerous.
Yeah.
Then I'll follow.
But a lot of other countries have been doing it successfully for a very long time. So I think having an open mind and being willing to try out these policies is actually important.
Right in the immediate future, what do you hope to see will happen?
Well, that's a very long wish list if you want me to get.
Okay, just pick one that you feel is the top priority.
For companies?
Yes.
I think the main thing is to be open to flexible and agile work arrangements because that is the one overarching policy that will not just encourage women back into the workforce, it will keep the millennials happy because the millennials tend to want flexibility. They tend to want to have a life outside of work. And it will also give other parts of the workforce the impetus to want to come to work. So, for instance, the older generation, and in light of the fact that we have an aging population, this policy hits all the right notes for me.
Amarjit Kaur, partner at Withers Carter Wong. It's been a pleasure speaking with you again, Amarjit. In the run-up to International Women's Day, thank you so much.
Thanks, Howie.
To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.